Springer Math Podcast.
In this month's podcast, our guest is Alessio Figale, Director of the Institute for Mathematical Research at ETH Zurich, Switzerland. Professor Figale completed his PhD at the Scuola Normale Superiore of Pisa in Italy and at the École Normale Supérieure of Lyon in France. He has also worked as a researcher at universities in France, the United States, and Switzerland. His achievements have been recognized with several prizes, including the Fields Medal in 2018 for his contributions to the theory of optimal transport, and the European Mathematical Society Prize in 2012 in recognition of his excellent contributions to mathematics. In a lively conversation with Luigi Ambrosio, a professor at the Scuola Normale Superiore, Figale discusses his early days in mathematics and his unique career path. He also comments on the differences in university systems among countries, how he manages his time with professional, personal, and family duties, the increasing importance of optimal transport in recent years, and his approach to problem solving in mathematics. Originally aired by the Unitech Springer Nature webinar series, this interview has been specifically adapted for the podcast format.
It's a pleasure to have this occasion to chat with Alessio. Alessio is a beloved student, former student of the Scuola Normale. We were considering that he left the Scuola now 15 years ago. And maybe I will try to alternate a little bit personal questions and also more academic or professional questions. So maybe let me start, Alessio, with this question. Maybe I know your story is very peculiar also from the point of view of the beginning of your career. So how did you discover, can you explain to the audience how you, did you discover your passion, for your interest for math, and then eventually how it happened that you came in contact with the Scuola Normale?
Okay, well, so first of all, let me just start by saying that also for me it's a great pleasure to be here, and also the fact that I'm interviewed by Luigi. It's very nice to have an occasion to chat. About your question, I wasn't like a student who was so into mathematics until late. In some sense, I was not doing much mathematics. I went to the classical high school in Italy. So I was doing classics, mostly Latin, Greek, philosophy, and so on. So in reality, I was doing very little math. Math was something that I liked, was something that I enjoyed. But in some sense, the number of hours I was spending on that was so little that it was even difficult for me to realize, how much I could have enjoyed to do more mathematics. It was really during high school at some moment where I started to be exposed to Math Olympiads that something changed at school, unfortunately, there is a tendency to never see the fun part of mathematics. There is a tendency to, give exercise to explain mathematics. First of all, not explaining what is the purpose of it. So why mathematics can be interesting, why we should care about math and so on. It looks something just, as another subject to learn. And then often many exercises that we have to solve as students are a bit repetitive and very mechanic, which of course is important to learn. In the big picture, they are very important, but it would be good sometimes also to get something a bit more interesting and exciting, also to see a bit of the creativity of a mathematical, or how a mathematical process and mathematical thinking goes. So this is something I could only experience later towards the end of my high school when I started to do Math Olympiads. And that was really a changing moment for me because, first of all, I was exposed to problems where some non-trivial thinking was required. At the very beginning, they looked essentially impossible to me. And by trying to solving them, by looking at the solutions, looking at other people solve them, I slowly learned how, you know, some problem, mathematical problem can be approached. I learned new mathematics, I learned new theorems. And then with time, I had at least a sense of how to attack these problems. And then by doing the Math Olympiads, well, I remember very well when I went to the national phase of the competition, then there were a lot of kids coming from all over Italy, and many were at the last year of high school. I was at the previous year, so the last but one. And they were talking about, oh, I would like to do mathematics at the university, and I would like perhaps to try to be a student in Scuola Normale. And for me, there were two new aspects here. One was do mathematics at university. I never thought much about that. I thought, well, I mean, if you like mathematics, probably you should do engineering or something where there is something to do, what there is to do in mathematics. And second, Scuola Normale also, I don't know, it never crossed my mind at that moment. So also probably coming from a big city, you know, coming from Rome, usually if you're in Rome, you have three universities in Rome, why would you go to Pisa? So this was a moment where I started to think, perhaps, why not? Scuola Normale would be great. Why not mathematics? I like it. And apparently people, so, you know, at these Olympiads, you meet also university professors and many people that work at university and tell you, no, but there is a lot to do in mathematics. You know, mathematics is still a very active field, and it's not just, you know, that, and you just have to learn mathematics from the last centuries. So overall, I convinced myself that it could have made sense. I remember when I finished high school and I tried the competition to enter Scuola Normale, I was still not sure what I wanted to do. I was not convinced at all that mathematics would have been the right choice for me. But then I passed the competition. I made it. I didn't think you were in my oral examination.
Really?
I think you were in my oral examination, but I cannot guarantee because, you know, I was young, but it's very possible. I think so. And then I don't know. Of course, I was very stressed because the math was my most common confident, but the physics part of the exam, I was more stressed out. But in the end, yeah, I made it. And then I said, okay, why not? Let's give it a try. And it was the beginning. I was now exposed to university mathematics. And that was really a revelation. I mean, I was exposed to completely new math that I didn't even think could exist. From the one aspect, it's very abstract. On the other end, things start to fit together as a much bigger picture. And this was really exciting for me. Yeah, and that was the beginning. Perhaps the only thing I remember, and we stop here on this point, but I was, you know, I really felt that I was so much behind everyone else in my year that I was very stressed. It was like, okay, if someone is going to kick out of Scuola Normale, because you can't be kicked out and there are people that have been kicked out, it's going to be me. So better study well, because otherwise I'm on that list of people where we'll have to, you know, not to be students anymore next year. And yeah, that was the beginning of a long mathematical path.
No, I think also in this respect, your story is peculiar. And yeah, by the way, I will check whether that year I was in the committee.
You can check 2002 oral examination.
Yeah, 2002. Yeah, also this idea that has to be destroyed of mathematics as a cooking book, a kind of cooking book. Yeah, it's very important also when we teach in the scuola, in the corsi di orientamento, we always try to explain this to our students to encourage them to enroll in mathematics. Coming back, let's say, to a more institutional question or professional. So your career has been unique also because in a very few years you passed very quickly, among different institutions. Well, after the Scuola Normale, France, US, then Switzerland, because in the beginning Italy, but not at as an academic. Can you somehow compare? Of course, it will be a very long and difficult answer, but what are the peculiar aspects, the strength and the weaknesses of these systems?
Okay, nice tricky question. Okay, so so I was in Italy. I was just first an undergraduate student and then a PhD student. I immediately moved to France. I should say I just refuse when people say that I'm one of the example of brain drain, in the sense that I had to leave Italy because I didn't have options. In my case, it didn't happen, right? So I was sometimes lucky that I could get very early a position in France. But it's not that it's not that Italy didn't give me options. It's just that in that case, France was probably very quick in giving me an option, very very quick, considering that it was the end of my first year of PhD. So then I moved to France. I was, first in Nice, then in Paris, before moving to US. 7 years in US, and then in Switzerland. So I think this. So from my view of the systems, I can see essentially three different systems, in the sense that Italy and France are in reality very similar in many aspects. You know, we are talking about fully public system, which are made of several universities, big universities in general, with a lot of faculties. Perhaps they suffer of being competitive, in the sense that the working conditions are not as good as the one in US or Switzerland. But okay, they also have their pluses. I think they still work very well. Of course, over time, if the financing keeps being cut, that's not this will be more and more felt. But I think the main, so when people say, oh, we have perhaps some problem in the Italian system, we should be like the US or other countries, I would say, okay, but let's start with something next to us. Like France is a very similar system. One shouldn't change too much, but there are some small key aspects that France has compared to us, which make a big difference compared to us, Italy. One simple thing is the fact that they never stop hiring people and they have continuity in the hiring system. Could be something maybe very innocent, but I think it makes a big difference because, good mathematicians or in general good academics knows that they will have a chance every year to get a permanent position, and this can make all the difference in the world for a person. There will be always hirings. The number is more or less steady every year, so it doesn't go like waves, big waves where there is no hiring, frozen hiring for many years, and then suddenly a lot of hirings altogether and so on. So I remember very well, it was 2007 when I moved, and slightly after we had a long, very difficult period for Italy because there were essentially no hirings whatsoever for many years until they opened again in the last few years. So this is something that France doesn't do. It's a simple difference, but I think it's an important difference. And also the financing is more stable, again, for the same kind of reasons. There is more continuity than ups and downs. US and Switzerland are very different in this respect. So maybe US, it works more most universities, even when they're public, in reality, they're essentially privately funded. So they work on the aspect that they have a lot of external collaborations and they get a lot of grants from external collaborations. When I was in US, I was in Austin. It's a public university where only 13% of the funding comes from the state and 87% comes from private. So in reality, it's not very publicly funded. And this means what? It means that the university has to get money from other income sources. This could be many things, but for instance, every time the university, first of all, collaborates a lot with industry. The university, whenever people bring grant, they take a part of the grant. And of course, there is a positive incentive to hire people who are able to raise money. On the other end, of course, there is a downside, of course, for academics which are in disciplines where it's more difficult to raise money, let's say, for instance, in classics or any kind of disciplines like this, of course, this could be a downside. For instance, salaries are lower in these disciplines. So is it the right solution? I'm not saying, I'm just saying this is a different system. It has its pluses and minuses again, but of course it's able to attract a lot of people because it's more competitive. there are less universities in the US compared to the population. And then, of course, you know, they're more expensive, high tuition for students, and so on. So it's another model. It's also cultural. Switzerland, it's publicly funded. So one could say, well, okay, we could immediately move Switzerland. But one has to think that in Switzerland, the population that goes to high to, from, let's say, to university is roughly 20% of the population at the age of students, right? So it means that 80% usually they go, they usually go, they work. They take more, already at the level of the high school, they start to learn a job already before, and then they work. So there is only a small fraction of the population in Switzerland that really moves to university. And this makes a difference again, because in reality in Switzerland there are only, I think, 8 universities total. They're all publicly funded, but it's not many. They're not huge, but they're big enough for the demand. So of course one has then, it's easier to get more resources because you have, again, from the point of view of the state, you need to fund less universities, and so it's easier. On the other hand, it's just a different system, which, you know, is based on a completely different culture for many aspects. This cut of 20% is done already before high school. So only roughly 20% of the students in Switzerland go to high school. In Italy, everyone goes to high school. The same in France, the same in many other countries. So, you know, every system has its peculiarities. What I think it's really a problem in Italy is usually the lack of continuity. I mean, the lack of financing. So there is continuity both in financing and in effect of hiring positions and having giving support to the university, and in general, in fact, to the school and to the, you know, institute, the structures. So that's I would say the main issue. It's too much linked to the current government rather than thinking of the, you know, university and the school being a system which is above politics and apolitical.
Maybe now let me go into another direction. Recently in Helsinki, I was at the opening ceremony, and as usual, we saw the videos by the Fields Medalists. And maybe in this occasion, it was stressed even more than in other occasions how important is the role of cooperation between mathematicians. So not portraying these medalists as a kind of gods, that, but also the human side behind our work, behind their work, the importance of family relations. I think it was very, very good way to portray the work of mathematicians. So you are known to everyone to be very efficient in whatever you do. So how can you manage all these responsibilities at so many different levels, professional, personal, family? And
do you have, so, I mean,
do you have a golden rule? Or?
No. So let's see. I think, so maybe first starting about your comment, I think you're perfectly right. So I think it's good that it's in the end, you know, it's important to remember that even when you go to this awards like the Fields Medal, you know, there is a human side behind everyone. And the fact that you are right, it's not gods who have this illumination and on their own they do exceptional mathematics. We are part of a community. We are part of a community and we benefit from the community in some sense. So there is the role of collaborations, which is extremely important. So if one thinks about all the people recently in Helsinki, but also previous examples, one can always see either some major work have been done anyhow with some collaborators, or anyhow is a research project that one builds up with other people, or even if it's not your collaborators, there are other people in the world who are doing the same things you are doing, and by working, having several people working on a topic, the topic advances more quickly, and then of course then the, you know, awards then are given for some specific result, but these many specific results, essentially almost all of them, will never exist without the support of other mathematicians that, you know, have contributed to a certain topic. So I think this is very important to give as a message. So That's a problem. The problem of prices. You have to give it to one person, right? But in some sense, it's really the there is also behind. I think behind every kind of price, there is also, I would say, there should be pride, some kind of pride to the whole community working in the topic, because really everyone has contributed in some way to this award. So this is one comment about putting all together. So I think to do research and to do essentially everything in life is very good to have a good life balance, because for instance, mathematics is a very creative topic, and of course you need to put hard work. You need to to spend several hours thinking about a problem for perhaps several months, sometimes several years, can go on forever. So there is of course a sort of obsession that we get when we study a problem. We want to solve it. But if we were living only with that obsession, probably that obsession will crush us more than help us. So then the balance in life, which could be given by many things, could be given by family, by, for instance, the life balance that we get when we teach to our students, and this gives us anyhow a sense of satisfaction. Many things help us in, become, I think, better researchers. Now, of course, the more things you have to do, the less time you have for many things. So the time is, then it becomes less and less. For instance, to do research, I remember very well when I was a student in Scuola Normale, I had all the time of the world. And now the time is extreme, is very, very little. And then you have to optimize. And I don't think there is a golden rule, because I think everyone is different. So I know that I'm very good in switching between different things. So I don't have a problem in doing something and then immediately after doing something completely different. Other people need, perhaps are more like, if I do something, I need to be inside in the right mood for some hours. And so I think the golden rule is very personal. Everyone has to find its own way of being more efficient. And this could be by saying, this morning it's only for myself. I don't reply to email. I don't look at I don't meet students. I don't do anything. I just work on my personal research. And then these afternoons I have students, meetings, interviews, and so on. I don't know. This could be one. Vice versa, it's easier to split. Everyone has to find its balance. But of course, being a bit efficient in the end, it's necessary. The more things you have to do in your daily life, I changed. I think I was efficient before, but in some sense I was efficient in a different way, because also the kind of tasks that were required from me were different. Then I adjusted over time, more and more.
Exactly. This is also what I remember. Also, when I was a student. In some sense, also when I was a PhD student at the school, I remember this possibility of having an entire day of thinking about the problem, which was kind of magic. But then, of course, life changes, and then you have to adapt to these changes. Maybe, it was announced also that we are going to talk about optimal transport. You started to work immediately at the Scuola Normale in this topic. In those years already this topic was booming, and we have seen also an evolution, because it started with applications to statistics, mathematical physics, but then they came applications to PDE in geometric analysis, now more recently machine learning and so on. What do you think about first of all, are you still interested in this topic, or what is your feeling about the future evolution?
So I started, maybe just as in one line, I guess almost everyone that is listening to us probably will have a sense, but just in case. So optimal transport is a topic that, exists since more than 200 years, but as a mathematical topic, essentially started really in the 1980s, I would say. If we think about modern mathematics. And in the last 35 years, essentially has really boomed for a variety of reasons. So you start from a very concrete problem, which is extremely interesting, right? So transporting objects, resources, whatever, from one place to another in the cheapest possible way. That's the goal. It's a classical problem in the calculus of variation that, we as in Pisa, we love that, right? Minimizing functionals. It started as a very concrete problem. It had application to economics. The Kantorovich got the Nobel Prize in economics for his work on optimal transport. But then it boomed in mathematics, I would say, first of all, because after the work of, in particular, Jan Brenier, it was clear that optimal transport could have been more than just the problem itself. So there was a very interesting problem, but also that could be connected to more things. And then I think the next key player in that was McCann. So we started to, I mean, I was a kid back then, so I didn't see anything back then, but people started to see, you know, mathematicians, that there was this problem that could be used in other areas. What is the principle? The principle is, you know, as mathematicians, once we think of a problem in abstract terms and we forget that we are transporting material, then you model it as transporting probability measures, because that's how you can represent some objects that you're transporting. And after that, it doesn't matter anymore whether what you're transporting is something very concrete or something absolutely abstract. And suddenly, now you're transporting sets, and you can prove isoperimetric inequalities using optimal transport. Back to measures, you can apply optimal transport in probability. Then you understand how measures move if you're on the flat space or you are on the Earth, and then you start to realize that optimal transport is connected to geometry and curvature, and you know, things just developed. I think most people would not even expected something so big. And very recently, machine learning, it's very natural a posteriori that it should be connected to it, but of course a posteriori everything is obvious. The reason is, if one, the simplest way to explain this, I think, to our audience is just probably image recognition, or in general, image, treatment of image. That's the easiest case, right? So in some sense, images are made of pixels. And therefore, if I have two images, I could compare them by looking how expensive it is for me to transport the pixel of one to the pixel of the other. And this allows me to say, now, for instance, whether when I look at two images, if they're close, perhaps they represent the same object. So if we think about machine learning, for instance, starting booming probably when they could recognize digits and then postcodes. Yeah, optimal transport, you could use it for that, right? You could read a bunch of numbers and then try to recognize them. I'm not saying this is the most efficient way, but I'm just trying to give a sense of why optimal transport naturally has connection, because you can transport everything. This is something that I would say now that it's clear that also the computer science community has absolutely understood. There is more and more interest. You see in computer science conferences that they talk about optimal transport, they look into optimal transport. People working on optimal transport start to even to move to the private to private companies, and the private companies want people to work on optimal transport. So it's a big boom, which is extremely, I would say, again, surprising. From my perspective, when I started to do optimal transport, I was very excited by the applications it had. So in my work, for instance, I used optimal transport to understand how to isoperimetric inequalities. So essentially what I informally say when, you know, the shape of crystals, how the crystals change their shape when you add some force on them, but really it's about geometric inequalities. Or for the semi-geostrophic equations, so equations in meteorology. So it's a partial differential equation, extremely complex, and then there is a nice change of variable that transforms this PDE, which is very complicated, into some other problem where optimal transport naturally arises. And without entering details, there was a key question that came out after optimal transport, which was about, let's say, regularity of optimal maps. The question that you can ask as a mathematician could be, okay, I'm transporting one density to another, so I have my two distributions that I want to transport. If I know that the objects, the distribution that I'm transporting are nice, can I say that the transport map, the optimal transport map between them will be nice? How this being nice is transferred from the density to the map? This is what is regularity theory. And this is something I studied a lot, and it's also played a key role, in particular in my case, for the Fields Medal. After that, you know, the fact that they changed, we were talking before about, you know, Italy, France, US, Switzerland. So moving from country to country, I started to be exposed to different mathematics. So optimal transport was very active in Italy and France. When I moved to US, especially Austin is like the center of free boundary problems. These problems where instead you look at a completely different things, so like a separation between phases. So let's say I have ice and water. I have the ice inside the water. The ice starts to melt, and I want to understand this melting phenomenon. I want to understand the frontier between ice and water. So how this surface that separates the two phases evolve in time. Then I started also to work on that. Perhaps this took me away a bit from material transport. Now lately, I've been starting again to be interested in especially more applied questions of optimal transport, which, I mean, they come as applied questions in reality, then they're purely theoretical, I mean, very mathematical. And I think actually there is going to be a lot to do still, because all these new connections also to machine learning are bringing up new questions in optimal transport. So yeah, I'm definitely interested in what's happening right now. I think it's very nice.
Yeah, so let me also elaborate a little bit about what you said. Well, first of all, I think the history of optimal transport is very interesting also from the point of view of, as I said, the history of ideas, because as you said, the problem was raised in the years of the French Revolution, then somehow forgotten, rediscovered by Kantorowicz around the 1940. But then, in some sense, all these ramifications to different fields came, I would say, almost independently. You quoted Brenier in France, McCann in Canada, Felix Otto in Germany. It's quite interesting that sometimes it happens that a problem somehow is in the air, and more or less independently, all these things start to fit together. Also, maybe let me reconnect a little bit also to machine learning. Sometimes I start to see, I'm not an expert, but I attended some workshops, I heard about this. I had the feeling that there is some analogy between optimal transport and machine learning, not only from the point of view of that you can use optimal transport inside machine learning or vice versa, but also that like optimal transport, this field seems to have the possibility to fertilize many other fields like PDEs, optimization, and so on. So linking, bringing some sense to new paradigm. Is it only my feeling, or do you also have the feeling that machine learning has this kind of potential of, let me say, independently of the validity of the applications, let me stress just this at the theoretical level.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think this is, of course, more of a general question, right? The two things, but definitely machine learning, it's still a very new area in reality. I mean, if we think, so it exists since a long time, but then the real boom has been very recent, and then there are so many theoretical questions still, even very basic, right? About so that's why many things work. I mean, are still not understood. So, and I agree, yeah, that you could have many connections still. So yeah, there are two similarities. One probably more concrete. One is more the connection, really practical question, how working on transport, but then the other level. I have your feeling. Absolutely.
Okay, so let me now go maybe again to a quite more personal question. When we look at you from the outside, as I already said, it seems that everything is so easy for you. And I can testify that I have seen you a bit tired only at the end of the PhD. I remember in the summer of the first year of PhD, you told me, well, I am a bit tired. And I remember also that this was a bit a legend also around the Georgi, that everything was easy for him and so on. While I remember also that at the ceremony of the Georgi's departure, the sister of the Georgi, Rosa, said, well, you know, this is not completely true. I remember occasions where Ennio was hardly working on a problem in isolation and things like that. So she denied a little bit this legend, even if, of course, I can testify that Georgi had an exceptional speed in many occasions, right? So what can you say about this?
Okay, I wouldn't put myself
on
the
you?
same.
What about you?
I don't consider myself where everything comes easy. Of course, you know, the point is this: mathematics is art, and I think no matter what, then maybe some things, of course, come more easily. But overall, I think we all pass through difficulties and problems more and more challenging. You get the frustration. I think, of course, one thing that helped me was my way of thinking. Since I told you, right? I always found it easy to switch. Perhaps it was very normal for me to think about multiple problems, and that has always helped me. For instance, through my research career, because then perhaps I have very difficult problem in mind. If we think about the one on optimal transport applied to the semi-Giostrofi equation, that's a problem you gave me actually in 2005, I think, roughly. And we solved it with Guido. It was 2012. So easy. Was not so easy. It took 7 years of trial and error. In reality, all the attempts we made in the years were completely wrong, because in reality, then the final proof that we found was completely different. Actually, none of the attempts we made were in that direction. In Oberwolfach in 2012. We had the key idea. Of course, I think it would be even also wrong to say, oh, then you lost your time the previous 7 years, because in reality, you know, by trying things and failing in making them work, you learn a lot of things. And this sometimes brings you to the right path. And so without that previous thinking, I would not have made it. But all I want to say is that, that was a successful story. Of course, there are many problems that we try to solve that don't work in them, right? I mean, I think we can have a list of them where we discussed over time, and one never gets really the right solution, of course. So, of course, it's legends come. I don't know. I think probably for also for the majority, of course, we always remember the moment where this person had the right idea, and that, of course, impresses us. So I'm also impressed when I'm with someone and suddenly, tuck, the idea comes, and you're like, oh, wow, how did you come up with that? But in reality, there are many situations where, someone brings me a problem and I have no clue how to solve it. And that's part of it. I think, research in general, mathematics is our example, right? My research in general is challenging because you're trying to do something that people couldn't do it before you, which means that in general it's difficult. I mean, that's a fact. Yeah. And I think it's important to say that, right? Because otherwise, many times when we get stuck, we could think, oh, I'm not good enough to do this job. What did I do? In reality, it's just, we all pass through that. And the number of problems we solve is way less than the one we try to solve. And that's how in the end, you build your career, you try to do your best and you solve problems that you're interested in, that took your energies for many times, but it's normal not to be able to solve many of them. So I wouldn't put a legend on me.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so maybe our time is maybe almost over. So let me maybe close with, a more local Italian question. I'm also very involved, also speaking at many levels with the Ministry of Education, trying to explain that many students of the Scuola Normale, but not only, many top students and researchers, which are, by the way, very well trained in the Italian system, they leave the Italian systems. And of course, this is a brain drain is a main concern for many of us, and in particular for the Scuola Normale, because of course we do a big investment on our students. Of course, we see a return because also in a broad sense, we see that there is a kind of very international network that we are building, but surely it should be possible to do a little better in this direction. So what are your ideas? And I think the reasons we already spoke about, the reasons of this diaspora. So maybe let's try to focus a little more on the recommendation. What would you suggest to improve?
Yeah, so I think, Scuola Normale, of course, is an example which is very dear to us because, you know, well, you are the director. I was a former student. I mean, it's clear that the fact that so many students leave is something that it's a pity, but I would say it's a bigger problem, right? Because three square miles is a small number, but then in reality, we have thousands of, you know, brilliant Italian students who leave every year and they move away. So I think there are two aspects, right? So the fact that, so if we want to restrict it just to the academic world, I think the fact that many students tend to leave at the early stage of the career is very healthy. So it's something that from which the Italian system could benefit a lot if the Italian system was able to bring them back. So this movement, especially at the PhD and postdoctoral level, this would be great if then people came back to Italy. So the problem is that, okay, in the past, you know, people had the tendency not to move at all. And now moving has been something which has become very easy for us. We do it, and then suddenly we go outside. And one discovers, you know, an easier... usually perhaps academic system, perhaps again, like having the possibility at an early stage of the career to get positions, something very well-structured, no surprises. So I think, at the level of the education, it's clear that there is this idea that one could get better working conditions and also in a clear also career path. I mean, if we want another example, there is the problem of becoming to get a position when you are young, and that's a big problem, big concern. And you could say, okay, you know, you open enough young junior position to make the most the best people stay, to guarantee them, you know, the best people can stay and do their career. But then if I'm inside the system and I want to be promoted, for instance, from associate to full, the system is based such that, you know, the university needs enough money to promote. And then it's a competition, internal competition, because if you have 10 associate professors and one position for full, all the 10th would like to do it. But then it becomes a competition between these 10, which is not healthy, because the promotion should be an individual task. It shouldn't be like me against you between colleagues. I don't think that's something that it's fair, especially because, you know, the idea is that you just grow inside your university, you're not moving again. So all this, so it's again a matter of having resources, right, to allow the people who deserve it to be promoted. This is what discourage people, right? This is clearly a fact. And then once you're outside, the problem is that perhaps you build your family outside, and then moving back, it's too late. But just then it's because you live outside. I mean, you don't move after 40s or something like that. It's very rare. It's very difficult. Right. So, of course, you want people to come back at an early stage. You would like people to go out after in their early 20s, 20, 25. But then by 30, you would like them to be back. I mean, that's if one wants to put just some rough time scale, I think.
So there is a time for mobility and there is a time for setting.
For stability. For stability. And then also, then I think also people that, you know, come from a very good technical training outside, they have also a lot of possibility in the private work, the private environment. I mean, you go in the private world and you have perhaps a PhD in mathematics, you have a lot of chances to be hired. I mean, I see it here. People go to Google, to IBM, Apple, all these international companies are attracting a lot of mathematicians. So perhaps also in Italy, that's something that goes out of our, you know, probably environment. But in some sense, in Italy, this is something which is lacking at the Italian level. The possibility, the good working conditions for people who have a very advanced training in scientific studies. That's also something that perhaps motivates people to leave, unfortunately.
Okay, so thank you very much, Alessio.
Thank you. Bye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Springer Math Podcast. Look out for another episode next month.